the 10th chapter of John, verse 10, Jesus said, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." Abundant life. This is what God wants for us. So what is abundant life? To be happy, at peace, to love and be loved. Is it about having what we value most? What do you value most? Here's a brief story about a young man named Jack Bennett who made a discovery in addressing that question. The telephone rang. It was a call from his mother. He answered it, and his mother told him, "Mr. Beltzer died last night. The funeral is Wednesday." Memories flashed through his mind like an old newsreel as he quietly remembered his childhood days. "Jack, did you hear me?" "Oh, sorry, Mom. Yeah, I heard you. It's just been so long since I thought of him. I'm sorry, but honestly, I thought he died years ago." "Well, he didn't forget you. Every time I saw him, he'd ask how you were doing. He'd reminisce about the many days you spent over on his side of the fence, as he put it. I love that old house. You know, Jack, after your father died, Mr. Beltzer stepped in to make sure you had a man's influence in your life." "Yeah, he's the one who taught me carpentry. I wouldn't be in this business if it weren't for him. He spent a lot of time teaching me things he thought were important. Mom, I'll be there for the funeral." As busy as he was, Jack kept his word. He caught the next flight to his hometown. Mr. Beltzer's funeral was small and uneventful. He had no children of his own, and most of his relatives had passed away. The night before he had to return home, Jack and his mom stopped by to see the old house next door one more time. It was exactly as he remembered. Every step held memories, every piece of furniture, every picture. Jack stopped suddenly. "What's wrong, Jack?" "The box is gone." "What box?" "There was a small gold box that he kept locked on top of his desk. I must have asked him 1,000 times what was inside. All he'd ever tell me was, 'The thing I value most.' It was gone. Everything about the house was exactly how Jack remembered it, except for the box. He figured someone from the Beltzer family must have taken it." It had been about 2 weeks since Mr. Beltzer died. Returning home from work one day, Jack discovered a note in his mailbox. "Signature required on a package. Please stop by the main post office within the next 3 days." Early the next day, Jack went to the post office and retrieved the package. The small box was old and looked like it had been mailed 100 years ago. The handwriting was difficult to read, but the return address caught his attention: Mr. Harold Beltzer. Jack took the box out to the car and ripped open the package. There inside was the gold box and an envelope. Jack's hands shook as he read the note inside. "Upon my death, please forward this box and its contents to Jack Bennett. It's the thing I value most in life." A small key was taped to the letter. His heart racing as tears filled his eyes, Jack carefully unlocked the box. There inside, he found a beautiful gold pocket watch. Running his fingers slowly over the finely etched casing, he unlatched the cover. Inside, he found these words engraved: "Jack, thanks for your time. Harold Beltzer. The thing he valued most was my time." Jack held the watch for a few minutes, then called his office and cleared his appointments for the next 2 days. "Why?" Janet, his assistant, asked. "I need to spend some time with my son. Oh, by the way, Janet, thanks for your time." In the parable of the rich man, we learn about someone who made the wrong choice in his use of time. He built bigger and bigger barns, anticipating that future day when he would at last eat, drink, and be merry. But he died before he got to enjoy any of it. There's a classic play by Samuel Beckett called Waiting for Godot. In the play, the main characters, two tramps, spend 2 days waiting for the mystical Godot, who they believe will change their lives for the better. Godot never comes. Is happiness the new Godot? Do we often live our lives waiting to be happy? I think we do. A researcher named Robert Waldinger gave a TED Talk not too long ago on the topic, What Makes a Good Life? Lessons from the Longest Study on Happiness. He commented that in a recent survey of millennials, they were asked what their most important life goals were. And over 80% said that a major goal for them was to get rich. Another 50% of those same young adults said a major life goal was to become famous. We're constantly told to push harder and achieve more to have a good life. But what if we could watch entire lives as they unfold through time and study people from the time they were teenagers all the way into old age to see what really makes people happy and healthy? A group of researchers from Harvard did exactly that in the longest study of adult life that's ever been done. For 75 years, they tracked the lives of 724 men, year after year, asking about their work, their home lives, their health, and asking all along the way without knowing how their lives were going to turn out. Through a combination of luck and the persistence of several generations of researchers, the study survives. About 60 of the original 724 men are still alive and participating. Dr. Waldinger is the fourth director of the study. Since 1938, they track the lives of two groups of men. The first group were sophomores at Harvard College when they started. They finished college during World War II and most went off to war. The second group of boys were from Boston's poorest neighborhoods, chosen specifically because they were from some of the most troubled and disadvantaged families in Boston of the 1930s. Most lived in tenements, many without running water. All of those in the study were interviewed and given regular medical exams. The study followed them as they became factory workers, doctors, lawyers, bricklayers. One became president of the United States. Some developed alcoholism, a few schizophrenia. 75 years later, the study continues. Many of the inner-city Boston men asked the researchers, "Why do you keep wanting to study me? My life just isn't that interesting." Oddly, the Harvard men never asked that question. So, what lessons have they learned? Well, the lessons aren't about wealth or fame or working harder. The clear lesson from this 75-year exhaustive study is good relationships keep us happier, period. They learned three big lessons about relationships. The first is that social connections are really good for us, and loneliness kills. People who are socially connected to family and friends are happier, physically healthier, and they live longer. Loneliness turns out to be toxic. The second big lesson is that it's not the number of friends you have or whether you're in a committed relationship. It's the quality of your close relationships that matters. When the researchers gathered together everything they knew about the men at age 50, it wasn't their middle-aged cholesterol levels that predicted how they were going to grow old. It was how satisfied they were in their relationships. And the third big lesson is that these relationships don't just protect our bodies, they protect our brains. Memories stay sharper longer. Relationships are messy and complicated and sometimes hard work. But the people who fare best in life are those that take the time to build good ones. Not everyone is like the rich man in the parable who died unexpectedly, perhaps young. My dad died young. He was told the day after Thanksgiving in 1988 that the colon cancer he'd fought 5 years earlier had returned and was now in his bones. He died the following Christmas Day, 2 weeks before he was due to retire. That was 30 years ago last Christmas. But his granddaughter, my daughter Katie, still remembers him well, even though she was only 8 at the time. She remembers the trip they made, just the two of them, to Disney World when she was only 5. When I left for my junior year of college to study in Barcelona, Spain for a year, Dad moped that he didn't think he could go a whole year without seeing me. When Mom suggested he come visit me at Christmas time, Dad said it would be too expensive. Mom quoted him the English poet Robert Herrick's famous caution to gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Dad planned an amazing trip that took us to France, Switzerland, Germany, and Italy. It's a memory I treasure. This was long before the cancer diagnosis. Dad simply made his family a priority. What reasons do we give ourselves for waiting to live abundantly? I'll start being really happy when I lose 20 pounds, when I make partner, when I pay off the mortgage, when I get straight A's, when I get pregnant, if I can hold my marriage together, if my parents finally approve. Letting go of the prerequisites for worthiness can actually be scary. I read once that waiting to begin being happy until I felt I was perfect enough or my life was perfect enough is like the rustic who waits on the bank of the river for the water to go by before crossing. The wait never ends. There are times when we need to be perfect or near perfect, such as constructing a bridge or performing surgery. But for most of the time, there's room for a margin of error. We become more resilient as we replace aspiration for perfection with the desire to learn and grow from our experiences. An attachment to being perfect reflects a lack of self-compassion and wisdom. Emotional health requires a gentleness toward ourselves as we embrace inevitable failures. In the marketplace, in our relationships, we often make decisions based on the best information we have. But we can't control life with all of its complexities and unknowns. We can't avoid making mistakes, but we can grow from them. Perhaps the most dangerous element of perfectionism is the expectation that others should be perfect, expecting them to fit into our model of what they should be. It's a fruitless effort that requires an enormous amount of energy. Sometimes we suffer a devastating loss and feel guilty at the thought of being happy. When I was 17, I read a book written by another 17-year-old who became a quadriplegic when she snapped her spinal cord in a diving accident. Her name was Johnny Erickson. She became a best-selling author of several books, a disability rights activist, and an accomplished painter. She paints with the brush in her mouth. In 1982, she married Ken Tada. They've been happily married for 37 years. Johnny decided that God wanted her to be happy and lead a full life, even in the face of great loss. Sometimes we just get distracted. We clutter up our lives with too much stuff. Our to-do lists are long. We become overcommitted and complain that that's the nature of life today in this era of technology and the responsibilities of family and jobs. It's often easier to just watch TV and disengage. But you know, it's really about choices. I'd like you to try an exercise when you get home. Step one, sit down by yourself with a mug of coffee or tea and make a list of the most important aspects of your life. What really matters to you? People tend to write down things like family, personal, spiritual growth, health, career success, making a difference in the world, travel, friends. You don't need to rank them necessarily, but thinking of these things with some priority can be helpful. Step two. Now, get out your calendar and take an inventory of the past few weeks and months. Make a list of where you spend your time and attention. Tell the truth. Even if there's a lot of time spent on the phone, watching TV, looking at Facebook, where do you devote the most time? Rank these things a bit. Step three. Okay, now, compare the two lists. If you're like most people, you may notice that the two lists are quite different. Often what we say is important to us is not where we devote much of our time, energy, and thought. I would recommend a fourth step in this process. Think about how you can make the two lists more aligned. It can take a good deal of courage and commitment to live our lives in alignment with what we really value. Create some action steps. Baby steps are best. Small changes moving in the direction you want to go. This doesn't mean you can't enjoy watching TV or being on your cell phone. I love the way my phone helps me stay connected to my kids and grandkids. And often watching a show with my husband is a good way to unwind at the end of a busy day. Just be conscious of what you can do to focus on what truly matters to you. Your values are hiding in your schedule. Make sure you aren't living your life in a way that is out of integrity with who you really are and what you really value. We spend far too much time mulling over the past and anticipating the future. Our minds try to take us to some place in the future, a place we convince ourselves will make everything worthwhile, where we will feel content. But that place doesn't exist in the future. Let's break the cycle of desiring to get to some moment other than the one that's in our presence. Let's not ignore the potential for joy and fulfillment that can be found in our lives right this moment. Every moment we wish away, ignore, or dismiss is not good enough. We never get back. Conversely, every moment is ours to seize and appreciate, to love ourselves and others and this amazing world. In the 90th Psalm, verse 12, a prayer of Moses, it reads, "So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom." Your happiness doesn't reside in the future, and it hasn't passed you by either. It's right here. Don't miss out the way the rich man in the parable did. Live your happiest life now. Live abundantly. Let us pray. Most holy Lord, teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom.